ashes. "They're not going anywhere," Leofric said scornfully, nodding at the priests who had stranded themselves 100 paces out in the swamp. The path was deceptive. It had offered an apparent route to the village, but then petered out amidst a patch of reeds where the priests huddled. They did not want to come back, and did not want to go forward, and so they stayed where they were, lost and cold and despairing. They looked as though they were arguing.
"We must help them,"
Aenfled said, and, when I said nothing, she protested that one of the women was holding a baby.
"We have to help them,"
she insisted. I was about to retort that the last thing we needed was more hungry mouths to feed, but her harsh words in the night had persuaded me that I had to do something to show her I was not as treacherous as she evidently believed. So I stood, hefted my shield, and started down the hill. The others followed, but before we were even halfway down I heard shouts from the west. The lone priest who had gone that way was now with 4 soldiers, and they turned as horsemen came from the trees. There were 6 horsemen, then 8 more appeared, then another 10, and I realized a whole column of mounted soldiers was streaming from the dead winter trees. They had black shields and black cloaks, so they had to be Guthrum's men. One of the priests, stranded in the swamp, ran back along the path, and I saw he had a sword and was going to help his companions. It was a brave thing for the lone priest to do, but quite useless. The 4 soldiers and the single priest were surrounded now. They were standing back to back, and the Danish horsemen were all around them, hacking down, and then 2 of the horsemen saw the priest with his sword and spurred towards him. "Those 2 are ours," I said to Leofric. That was stupid. The 4 men were doomed, as was the priest if we did not intervene. But there were only 2 of us, and, even if we killed the 2 horsemen, we would still face overwhelming odds. But I was driven by Aenfled's scorn, and I was tired of skulking through the winter countryside, and I was angry. And so I ran down the hill, careless of the noise I made as I crashed through brittle undergrowth. The lone priest had his back to the swamp now, and the horsemen were charging at him as Leofric and I burst from the trees and came at them from their left side. I hit the nearest horse's flank with my heavy shield. There was a scream from the horse and an explosion of wet soil, grass, snow and hooves as man and beast went down sideways. I was also on the ground, not there by the impact, but I recovered first, and found the rider tangled with his stirrups, 1 leg trapped under the struggling horse, and I chopped Serpent Breath down hard. I cut into his throat, stamped on his face, chopped again, slipped in his blood, then left him and went to help Leofric, who was fending off the 2nd man who was still on horseback. The Dane's sword thumped on Leofric's shield. Then he had to turn his horse to face me, and Leofric's axe took the horse in the face, and the beast reared. The rider slid backwards, and I met his spine with Serpent Breath's tip. 2 down. The priest with the sword, not a 6 paces away, had not moved. He was just staring at us. "Get back into the marsh!" I shouted at him. "Go! Go!" Isolt and Aenfled were with us now, and they seized the priest and hurried him towards the path. It might lead nowhere, but it was better to face the remaining Danes there than on the firm ground at the hill's foot. And those black-cloaked Danes were coming. They had slaughtered the handful of soldiers, seen their 2 men killed, and now came for vengeance. "Come on!" I snarled at Leofric, and, taking the wounded horse by the reins, I ran on to the small twisting path. "A horse won't help you here," Leofric said. The horse was nervous. Its face was wounded, and the path was slippery. But I dragged it along the track until we were close to the small patch of land where the refugees huddled. And by now the Danes were also on the path following us. They dismounted. They could only come 2 abreast, and in places only 1 man could use the track, and in 1 of those places I stopped the horse and exchanged Serpent Breath for Leofric's axe. The horse looked at me with a big brown eye. "This is for Odin," I said, and I swung the axe into its neck, chopping down through mane and hide. And a woman screamed behind me, as the blood spurted bright and high in the dull day. The horse whinnied, tried to rear, and I swung again, and this time the beast went down, thrashing hooves, blood and water splashing. Snow turned red as I axed it a third time, finally stilling it. And now the dying beast was an obstacle athwart the track, and the Danes would have to fight across its corpse. I took Serpent Breath back. "We'll kill them one by one," I told Leofric.
"For how long?"
He nodded westwards, and I saw more Danes coming. A whole ship's crew of mounted Danes streaming along the swamp's edge. 50 men, maybe more. But even so, they could only use the path in ones or twos, and they would have to fight over the dead horse into Serpent Breath and Leofric's axe. He had lost his own axe, taken from him when he was brought to Sippenham, but he seemed to like his stolen weapon. He made the sign of the cross, touched the blade, then hefted his shield as the Danes came. Two young men came first. They were wild and savage, wanting to make a reputation. But the first to come was stopped by Leofric's axe banging into his shield, and I swept Serpent Breath beneath the shield to slice his ankle, and he fell, cursing, to tangle his companion, and Leofric wrenched the wide-bladed axe free and slashed it down again. The second man stumbled on the horse, and Serpent Breath took him under the chin, above his leather coat, and the blood ran down her blade in a sudden flood. And now there were two Danish corpses added to the horse-flesh barricade. I was taunting the other Danes, calling them corpse-worms, telling them I'd known children who could fight better. Another man came, screaming in rage as he leapt over the horse, and he was checked by Leofric's shield, and Serpent Breath met his sword with a dull crack, and his blade broke. And two more men were trying to get past the horse, struggling in water up to their knees, and I rammed Serpent Breath into the belly of the first, pushing her through his leather armour, left him to die, and swung right at the man, trying to get through the water. Serpent Breath's tip flicked across his face to spray blood into the thickening snowfall. I went forward, feet sinking, lunged again, and he could not move in the mire, and Serpent Breath took his gullet. I was screaming with joy, because the battle calm had come, the same blessed stillness I had felt at Sinuit. It is a joy, that feeling, and the only other joy to compare is that of being with a woman. It's as though life slows. The enemy moves as if he is wading in mud, but I was kingfisher fast. There is rage, but it is a controlled rage, and there is joy. The joy that the poets celebrate when they speak of battle, and a certainty that death is not in that day's fate. My head was full of singing, a keening note high and shrill, death's anthem. All I wanted was for more Danes to come to Serpent Breath, and it seemed to me that she took on her own life in those moments. To think was to act. A man came across the horse's flank. I thought to slice at his ankle, knew he would drop his shield, and so open his upper body to an attack. And before the thought was even coherent, it was done, and Serpent Breath had taken one of his eyes. She had gone down and up, was already moving to the right to counter another man trying to get around the horse, and I let him get past the stallion's bloodied head, then scornfully drove him down into the water. And there I stood on him, holding his head under my boot as he drowned. I screamed at the Danes, told them I was Valhalla's gatekeeper, that they had been weaned on coward's milk, and that I wanted them to come to my blade. I begged them to come. But six men were dead around the horse, and the others were now weary. I stood on the dead horse and spread my arms. I held the shield high to my left and the sword to my right, and my mail coat was spattered with blood, and the snow fell about my wolf-crested helmet. And all I knew was the young man's joy of slaughter. "I killed Uber Lothbrokson," I shouted at them. "I killed him. So come and join him. Taste his death. My sword wants you." "Boats," Leofric said. I didn't hear him. The man I thought had drowned was still alive, and he suddenly reared from the marsh, choking and vomiting water, and I jumped down off the horse and put my foot on his head again.
"Let him live,"
a voice shouted behind me.
"I want a prisoner."
The man tried to fight my foot, but Serpent Breath put him down. He struggled again, and I broke his spine with Serpent Breath, and he was still.
"I said I wanted a prisoner,"
the voice behind protested.
"Come and die,"
I shouted at the Danes. Boats, Leofric said again. And I glanced behind and saw three punts coming through the marsh. They were long flatboats, propelled by men with poles, and they grounded on the other side of the huddled refugees who hurried aboard. The Danes, knowing Leofric and I had to retreat if we were to gain the safety of the boats, readied for a charge, and I smiled at them, inviting them. One boat left, Leofric said. Room for us. You'll have to run like hell. I'll stay here, I shouted, but in Danish. I'm enjoying myself. Then there was a stir on the path, as a man came to the front rank of the Danes, and the others edged aside to give him room. He was in chainmail, and had a silvered helmet with a raven's wing at its crown. But as he came closer, he took the helmet off, and I saw the gold-tipped bone in his hair. It was Guthrum himself. The bone was one of his mother's ribs, and he wore it out of love for her memory. He stared at me, his gaunt face sad, and then looked down at the men we had killed. "I shall hunt you like a dog, Uhtred Ragnarsson," he said. "And I shall kill you like a dog." "My name," I said, "is Uhtred Uhtredsson." "We have to run," Leofric hissed at me. The snow whirled above the swamp, thick enough now so that I could hardly see the ridgetop from where we had glimpsed the pigeons circling. "You are a dead man, Uhtred," Guthrum said. "I never met your mother," I called to him, "but I would have liked to meet her." His face took on the reverent look that any mention of his mother always provoked. He seemed to regret that he had spoken so harshly to me, for he made a conciliatory gesture. "She was a great woman," he said. I smiled at him. At that moment, looking back, I could have changed sides so easily, and Guthrum would have welcomed me if I had just given his mother a compliment. But I was a belligerent young man, and the battle joy was on me. "I would have spat in her ugly face," I told Guthrum. "And now I piss on your mother's soul, and tell you that the beasts of Nilfheim are humping her rancid bones." He screamed with rage, and they all charged, some splashing through the shallows, all desperate to reach me and avenge the terrible insult. But Leofric and I were running like hunted boars, and we charged through the reeds and into the water, and hurled ourselves onto the last punt. The first two were gone, but the third had waited for us, and as we sprawled on its damp boards, the man with the pole pushed hard, and the craft slid away into the black water. The Danes tried to follow, but we were going surprisingly fast, gliding through the snowfall, and Guthrum was shouting at me, and a spear was thrown, but the marshman poled again, and the spear plunged harmlessly into the mud.
"I shall find you,"
Guthrum shouted.
"Why should I care?" I called back. "Your men only know how to die."
I raised Serpent Breath and kissed her sticky blade.
"And your mother was a whore to dwarves."
"You should have let that one man live," a voice said behind me. "Because I wanted to question him."
The punt only contained the one passenger besides Leofric and myself. And that one man was the priest who had carried a sword, and now he was sitting in the punt's flat bow, frowning at me.
"There was no need to kill that man," he said sternly.
And I looked at him with such fury that he recoiled. "Damn all priests," I thought. "I had saved the bastard's life, and all he did was reprove me." And then I saw that he was no priest at all. It was Alfred. The punt slid over the swamp, sometimes gliding across black water, sometimes rustling through grass or reeds. The man poling it was a bent, dark-skinned creature with a massive beard, otter-skin clothes and a toothless mouth. Guthrum's Danes were far behind now, carrying their dead back to firmer ground.
"I need to know what they plan to do," Alfred complained to me. "The prisoner could have told us."
He spoke more respectfully. Looking back, I realized I'd frightened him, for the front of my mail coat was sheeted in blood, and there was more blood on my face and helmet. "They plan to finish Wessex," I said curtly. "You don't need a prisoner to tell you that."
"Lord,"
he said. I stared at him.
"I am a king,"
he insisted.
"You address a king with respect."
"A king of what?" I asked. "You're not hurt, Lord?" Leofric asked Alfred.
"No, thank God. No."
He looked at the sword he carried.
"Thank God."
I saw he was not wearing priest's robes, but a swathing black cloak. His long face was very pale.
"Thank you, Leofric," he said,
then looked up at me and seemed to shudder. We were catching up with the other two punts, and I saw that Aelswith, pregnant and swathed in a silver fox fur cloak, was in one. Isolt and Eanfleed were also in that punt, while the priests were crowded onto the other, and I saw that Bishop Aelwald of Exoncester was one of them.
"What happened, Lord?" Leofric asked.
Alfred sighed. He was shivering now, but he told his story. He had ridden from Sippenham with his family, his bodyguard, and a score of churchmen to accompany the monk Asser on the first part of his journey.
"We had a service of thanksgiving," he said, "in the church at Sopenbeag. It's a new church," he added earnestly to Leofric, "and very fine. We sang psalms, said prayers, and Brother Asser went on his way, rejoicing."
He made the sign of the cross.
"I pray he's safe."
"I hope the lion bastard's dead," I snarled. Alfred ignored that. After the church service, they had all gone to a nearby monastery for a meal, and it was while they were there that the Danes had come. The royal group had fled, finding shelter in nearby woods while the monastery burned. After that, they had tried to ride east into the heart of Wessex, but, like us, they had constantly been headed off by patrolling Danes. One night, sheltering in a farm, they had been surprised by Danish troops who had killed some of Alfred's guards and captured all his horses, and ever since they had been wandering, as lost as us, until they came to the swamp.
"God knows what will happen now," Alfred said.
"We fight,"
I said. He just looked at me, and I shrugged.
"We fight,"
I said again. Alfred stared across the swamp.
"Find a ship,"
he said, but so softly that I hardly heard him.
"Find a ship and go to Francia."
He pulled the cloak tighter around his thin body. The snow was thickening as it fell, though it melted as soon as it met the dark water. The Danes had vanished, lost in the snow behind.
"That was Guthrum?"
Alfred asked me. "That was Guthrum," I said. "And he knew it was you he pursued."
"I suppose so."
"What else would draw Guthrum here?" I asked. "He wants you dead, or captured." Yet for the moment we were safe. The island village had a score of damp hovels thatched with reeds and a few storehouses raised on stilts. The buildings were the colour of mud. The street was mud. The goats and the people were mud-covered. But the place, poor as it was, could provide food, shelter, and a meagre warmth. The men of the village had seen the refugees, and, after a discussion, decided to rescue them. I suspect they wanted to pillage us rather than save our lives, but Leofric and I looked formidable. And once the villagers understood that their king was their guest, they did their clumsy best for him and his family. One of them, in a dialect I could scarcely understand, wanted to know the king's name. He had never heard of Alfred. He knew about the Danes, but said their ships had never reached the village, or any of the other settlements in the swamp. He told us the villagers lived off deer, goats, fish, eels, and wildfowl, and they had plenty of food, though fuel was scarce. Aelswith was pregnant with her third child, while her first two were in the care of nurses. There was Edward, Alfred's heir, who was 3 years old and sick. He coughed, and Aelswith worried about him, though Bishop Aylward insisted it was just a winter's cold. Then there was Edward's elder sister, Ethelfled, who was now 6, and had a bright head of golden curls, a beguiling smile and clever eyes. Alfred adored her, and in those first days in the swamp, she was his one ray of light and hope. One night, as we sat by a small dying fire, and Ethelfled slept with her golden head in her father's lap, he asked me about my son.
"I don't know where he is," I said. There were only the two of us. Everyone else was sleeping, and I was sitting by the door, staring across the frost-bleached marsh that lay black and silver under a half-moon.
"You want to go and find him?"
he asked earnestly. "You truly want me to do that?" I asked. He looked puzzled. "These folk are giving you shelter," I explained, "but they'd as soon cut your throats. They won't do that while I'm here." He was about to protest, then understood I probably spoke the truth. He stroked his daughter's hair. Edward coughed. He was in his mother's hut. The coughing had become worse, much worse, and we all suspected it was the whooping cough that killed small children. Alfred flinched at the sound.
"Did you fight Stiepa?"
he asked. "We fought," I said curtly. "The Danes came, and we never finished. He was bleeding, I was not."
"He was bleeding?"
"That's Leofric. He was there." He was silent a long time. Then, softly,
"I am still king."
"Of a swamp," I thought, and said nothing.
"And it is customary to call a king lord?"
he went on. I just stared at his thin, pale face that was lit by the dying fire. He looked so solemn, but also frightened, as if he were making a huge effort to hold on to the shreds of his dignity. Alfred never lacked for bravery, but he was not a warrior, and he did not much like the company of warriors. In his eyes, I was a brute, dangerous, uninteresting, but suddenly indispensable. He knew I was not going to call him lord, so he did not insist.
"What do you notice about this place?"
he asked. "It's wet," I said.
"And what else?"
I looked for the trap in the question and found none. "It can only be reached by punts," I said. "And the Danes don't have punts. But when they do have punts, it'll need more than Leofric and me to fight them off."
"It doesn't have a church,"
he said. "I knew I liked it," I retorted. He ignored that.
"We know so little of our own kingdom," he said in wonderment. "I thought there were churches everywhere."
He closed his eyes for a few heartbeats, then looked at me plaintively.
"What should I do?"
I told him to fight, but I could see no fight in him now. Just despair. "You can go south," I said, thinking that was what he wanted to hear. "Go south across the sea."
"To be another exiled Saxon king," he said bitterly.
"We hide here," I said, "and when we think the Danes aren't watching, we go to the south coast and find a ship."
"How do we hide?"
he asked.
"They know we're here, and they're on both sides of the swamp."
The marshmen had told us that a Danish fleet had landed at Sinuit, which lay at the swamp's western edge. That fleet, I assumed, was led by Svein, and he would surely be wondering how to find Alfred. The king, I reckoned, was doomed, and his family too. If Ethelfled was lucky, she would be raised by a Danish family, as I had been. But more probably, they would all be killed, so that no Saxon could ever again claim the crown of Wessex.
"And the Danes will be watching the south coast,"
Alfred went on. "They will," I agreed. He looked out at the marsh where the night wind rippled the waters, shaking the long reflection of a winter moon.
"The Danes can't have taken all Wessex," he said,
then flinched because Edward was coughing so painfully. "Probably not,"
I agreed.
If we could find men,
he said, then fell silent.
What would we do with men?
I asked.
Attack the fleet,
he said, pointing west.
Get rid of Svein. If it is Svein at Sinuit, then hold the hills of Devonshire. Gain one victory and more men will come. We get stronger and one day we can face Guthrum.
I thought about it. He had spoken dully, as if he did not really believe in the words he had said. But I thought they made a perverse kind of sense. There were men in Wessex, men who were leaderless. But they were men who wanted a leader, men who would fight. And perhaps we could secure the swamp, then defeat Svein, then capture Devonshire, and so, piece by piece, take back Wessex. Then I thought about it more closely, and reckoned it was a dream. The Danes had won. We were fugitives. Alfred was stroking his daughter's golden hair.
The Danes will hunt us here, won't they?
Yes.
Can you defend us?
Just me and Leofric.
You're a warrior, aren't you? Men tell me it was really you who defeated Uber.
You knew I killed Uber, I asked.
Can you defend us?
I would not be deflected. Did you know I won your victory at Sinuit? I demanded.
Yes,
he said simply.
And my reward was to crawl to your altar, to be humiliated.
My anger made my voice too loud, and Æthelflaed opened her eyes and stared at me.
I have made mistakes,
Alfred said.
And when this is all over, and when God returns Wessex to the West Saxons, I shall do the same. I shall put on the penitent's robe and submit myself to God.
I wanted to kill the pious bastard then, but Æthelflaed was watching me with her big eyes. She'd not moved, so her father did not know she was awake. But I did. So instead of giving my anger a loose rein, I cut it off abruptly. You'll find that penitence helps, I said. He brightened at that.
It helped you?
He asked. It gave me anger, I said. And it taught me to hate. And anger is good. Hatred is good.
You don't mean that,
he said. I have true serpent breath, and little Æthelflaed's eyes grew wider. This kills, I said, letting the sword slide back into its fleece-lined scabbard. But anger and hate are what gives it the strength to kill. Go into battle without anger and hate, and you'll be dead. You need all the blades, anger, and hate you can muster if we're to survive.
But can you do it?
He asked.
Can you defend us here, long enough to evade the Danes while we decide what to do?
Yes, I said. I had no idea whether I spoke the truth. Indeed, I doubted that I did. But I had a warrior's pride, so gave a warrior's answer. Æthelflaed had not taken her eyes from me. She was only 6, but I swear she understood all that we talked about.
So I give you charge of that task,
Alfred said.
Here and now I appoint you as the defender of my family. Do you accept that responsibility?
I was an arrogant brute. Still am. He was challenging me, of course, and he knew what he was doing, even if I did not. I just bridled. Of course I accept it, I said. Yes.
Yes what?
He asked. I hesitated, but he had flattered me, given me a warrior's responsibility, and so I gave him what he wanted, and what I had been determined not to give to him. Yes, Lord, I said. He held out his hand. I knew he wanted more now. I'd never meant to grant him this wish, but I had called him Lord, and so I knelt to him, and across Æthelflaed's body, I took his hand in both mine.
Say it,
he demanded, and he put the crucifix that hung about his neck between our hands. I swear to be your man, I said, looking into his pale eyes. Until your family is safe. He hesitated. I'd given him the oath, but I had qualified it. I'd let him know that I would not remain his man forever. But he accepted my terms. He should have kissed me on both cheeks, but that would have disturbed Æthelflaed. And so he raised my right hand and kissed the knuckles, then kissed the crucifix.
Thank you, he said.
The truth, of course, was that Alfred was finished. But with the perversity and arrogance of foolish youth, I'd just given him my oath and promised to fight for him. And all, I think, because a 6-year-old stared at me. And she had hair of gold.
Chapter 7
The kingdom of Wessex was now a swamp, and for a few days it possessed a king, a bishop, 4 priests, 2 soldiers, the king's pregnant wife, 2 nurses, a whore, 2 children, one of whom was sick, and Isolde. 3 of the 4 priests left the swamp first. Alfred was suffering, struck by the fever and belly pains that so often afflicted him, and he seemed incapable of rousing himself to any decision. So I gathered the 3 youngest priests, told them they were useless mouths we could not afford to feed, and ordered them to leave the swamp and discover what was happening on dry ground. "Find soldiers," I told them, "and say the king wants them to come here." 2 of the priests begged to be spared the mission, claiming they were scholars incapable of surviving the winter, or of confronting the Danes, or of enduring discomfort, or of doing any real work. And Aelwold, the bishop of Exoncester, supported them, saying that their joint prayers were needed to keep the king healthy and safe. So I reminded the bishop that Æthelflaed was present.
Æthelflaed?
He blinked at me as though he'd never heard the name. The whore, I said, from Sippenham. He still looked ignorant. Sippenham, I went on, where you and she rutted in the Corncrake Tavern, and she said,
though the priests will travel,
he said hastily. Of course they will, I said. But they'll leave their silver here.
Silver?
The priests had been carrying Aelwold's hoard, which included the great pyx I had given him to settle Mildred's debts. That hoard was my next weapon. I took it all and displayed it to the marshmen. There would be silver, I said, for the food they gave us, and fuel they brought us, and the punts they provided, and the news they told us. News of the Danes on the swamp's far side. I wanted the marshmen on our side, and the sight of the silver encouraged them. But Bishop Aelwold immediately ran to Alfred and complained that I had stolen from the church. The king was too low in spirits to care, so Aelswith, his wife, entered the fray. She was a Mercian, and Alfred had married her to tighten the bonds between Wessex and Mercia, though that did little good for us now, because the Danes ruled Mercia. There were plenty of Mercians who would fight for a West Saxon king, but none would risk their lives for a king reduced to a soggy realm in a tidal swamp.
"You will return the picks," Elswith ordered me.
She looked ragged, her greasy hair tangled, her belly swollen and her clothes filthy.
"Give it back now, this instant."
I looked at Isolde. "Should I?"
"No,"
Isolde said.
"She has no say here,"
Aelswith shrieked. "But she's a queen," I said.
"And you're not."
That was one cause of Aelswith's bitterness, for the West Saxons never called the king's wife a queen. She wanted to be Queen Aelswith, and had to be content with less. She tried to snatch back the pyx, but I tossed it on the ground, and when she reached for it, I swung Leofric's axe. The blade chewed into the big plate, mangling the silver crucifixion, and Aelswith squealed in alarm and backed away as I hacked again. It took several blows, but I finally reduced the heavy plate into shreds of mangled silver that I tossed onto the coins I had taken from the priests.
Silver, for your help,
I told the marshmen. Aelswith spat at me, then went back to her son. Edward was 3 years old, and it was evident now that he was dying. Aelwold had claimed it was a mere winter's cold, but it was plainly worse, much worse. Every night we would listen to the coughing, an extraordinary hollow racking sound from such a small child, and all of us lay awake, dreading the next bout, flinching from the desperate rasping sound. And when the coughing fits ended, we feared they would not start again. Every silence was like the coming of death. Yet somehow, the small boy lived, clinging on through those cold, wet days in the swamp. Bishop Aelwold and the women tried all they knew. A gospel book was laid on his chest and the bishop prayed. A concoction of herbs, chicken dung and ash was pasted on his chest and the bishop prayed. Alfred travelled nowhere without his precious relics, and the toe ring of Mary Magdalene was rubbed on the child's chest, and the bishop prayed. But Edward just became weaker and thinner. A woman of the swamp, who had a reputation as a healer, tried to sweat the cough from him, and when that did not work, she attempted to freeze it from him, and when that did not work, she tied a live fish to his chest, and commanded the cough and the fever to flee to the fish. And the fish certainly died, but the boy went on coughing, and the bishop prayed, and Alfred, as thin as his sick son, was in despair. He knew the Danes would search for him, but so long as the child was ill, he dared not move, and he certainly could not contemplate the long walk south to the coast, where he might find a ship to carry him and his family into exile. He was resigned to that fate now. He had dared to hope he might recover his kingdom, but the cold reality was more persuasive. The Danes held Wessex, and Alfred was king of nothing, and his son was dying.
"It is a retribution," he said.
It was the night after the three priests had left, and Alfred unburdened his soul to me and Bishop Aelwold. We were outside, watching the moon silver the marsh mists, and there were tears on Alfred's face. He was not really talking to either of us, only to himself. "God would not take a son to punish the father," Aelwold said.
"God sacrificed his own son,"
Alfred said bleakly.
"And he commanded Abraham to kill Isaac."
"He spared Isaac," the bishop said.
"But he is not sparing Edward,"
Alfred said, and flinched as the awful coughing sounded from the hut. He put his head in his hands, covering his eyes. "Retribution for what?" I asked, and the bishop hissed in reprimand for such an indelicate question. "Ethelwold," Alfred said bleakly. Ethelwold was his nephew, the drunken, resentful son of the old king. "Ethelwold could never have been king," Aelwold said. "He's a fool."
"If I name him king now,"
Alfred said, ignoring what the bishop had said,
"perhaps God will spare Edward."
The coughing ended. The boy was crying now, a gasping, grating, pitiful crying, and Alfred covered his ears with his hands. "Give him to Isolde," I said.
"A pagan,"
Aelwold warned Alfred. "An adulteress." I could see Alfred was tempted by my suggestion, but Aelwold was having the better of the argument.
"If God will not cure Edward," the bishop said, "do you think he will let a witch succeed?"
"She's no witch," I said.
"Tomorrow," Aelwold said, ignoring me, "is St. Agnes's Eve, a holy day, Lord, a day of miracles. We shall pray to St. Agnes, and she will surely unleash God's power on the boy."
He raised his hands to the dark sky.
"Tomorrow, Lord, we shall summon the strength of the angels. We shall call heaven's aid to your son, and the blessed Agnes will drive the evil sickness from young Edward."
Alfred said nothing, just stared at the swamp's pools that were edged with a thin skim of ice that seemed to glow in the wan moonlight.
I have known the Blessed Agnes perform miracles,
the bishop pressed the king.
There was a child in Exoncester who could not walk, but the saint gave him strength, and now he runs.
Truly? Alfred asked.
With my own eyes,
the bishop said.
I witnessed the miracle.
Alfred was reassured.
Tomorrow, then,
he said. I did not stay to see the power of God unleashed. Instead, I took a punt and went south to a place called Aetherlingig, which lay at the southern edge of the swamp and was the biggest of all the marsh settlements. I was beginning to learn the swamp. Leofric stayed with Alfred to protect the king and his family, but I explored, discovering scores of trackways through the watery void. The paths were called beamwegs, and were made of logs that squelched underfoot, but by using them I could walk for miles. There were also rivers that twisted through the lowland, and the biggest of those, the Pedradon, flowed close to Aetherlingig, which was an island, much of it covered with alders in which deer and wild goats lived. But there was also a large village on the island's highest spot, and the head man had built himself a great hall there. It was not a royal hall, not even as big as the one I had made at Oxton, but a man could stand upright beneath its beams, and the island was large enough to accommodate a small army. A dozen beamwegs led away from Aetherlingig, but none led directly to the mainland. It would be a hard place for Guthrum to attack, because he would have to thread the swamp. But Svein, who we now knew commanded the Danes at Sinuit, at the Pedradon's mouth, would find it an easy place to approach, for he could bring his ships up the river, and, just north of Aetherlingig, he could turn south onto the river Thon, which flowed past the island. I took the punt into the centre of the Thon, and discovered, as I had feared, that it was more than deep enough to float the Danes' beast-headed ships. I walked back to the place where the Thon flowed into the Pedradon. Across the wider river was a sudden hill, steep and high, which stood in the surrounding marshland like a giant's burial mound. It was a perfect place to make a fort, and if a bridge could be built across the Pedradon, then no Danish ship could pass upriver. I walked back to the village, where I discovered that the headman was a grizzled and stubborn old man called Haswald, who was disinclined to help. I said I would pay good silver to have a bridge made across the Pedradon, but Haswald declared the war between Wessex and the Danes did not affect him.
"There's madness over there," he said, waving vaguely at the eastern hills. "There's always madness over there. But here in the swamp we mind our own business. No one minds us, and we don't mind them."
He stank of fish and smoke. He wore otterskins that were greasy with fish oil, and his greying beard was flecked by fish scales. He had small cunning eyes in an old cunning face, and he also had a half-dozen wives, the youngest of whom was a child, who could have been his own granddaughter, and he fondled her in front of me, as if her existence proved his manhood.
"I'm happy," he said, leering at me. "So why should I care for your happiness?"
"The Danes could end your happiness."
"The Danes?"
He laughed at that, and the laugh turned into a cough. He spat.
"Well, if the Danes come," he went on, "then we go deep into the swamp, and the Danes go."
He grinned at me, and I wanted to kill him. But that would have done no good. There were 50 or more men in the village, and I would have lasted all of a dozen heartbeats. Though the man I really feared was a tall, broad-shouldered, stooping man with a puzzled look on his face. What frightened me about him was that he carried a long hunting bow. Not one of the short fowling bows that many of the marshmen possessed, but a stag killer, as tall as a man, and capable of shooting an arrow clean through a mail coat. Haswald must have sensed my fear of the bow, for he summoned the man to stand beside him. The man looked confused by the summons, but obeyed. Haswald pushed a gnarled hand under the young girl's clothes, then stared at me as he fumbled, laughing at what he perceived as my impotence.
The Danes come, he said again, and we go deep into the swamp, and the Danes go away.
He thrust his hand deeper into the girl's goatskin dress and mauled her breasts.
Danes can't follow us, and if they do follow us, then Eofor kills them.
Eofor was the archer, and hearing his name, he looked startled, then worried.
Eofor's my man, Aswald boasted. He puts arrows where I tell him to put them.
Eofor nodded. Your king wants a bridge made, I said. A bridge and a fort.
King? Aswald stared about the village. I know no king. If any man is king here, 'tis me.
He cackled with laughter at that, and I looked at the villagers and saw nothing but dull faces. None shared Haswald's amusement. They were not, I thought, happy under his rule, and perhaps he sensed what I was thinking, for he suddenly became angry, thrusting his girl bride away.
Leave us!
He shouted at me.
Just go away!
I went away, returning to the smaller island where Alfred sheltered and where Edward lay dying. It was nightfall, and the bishop's prayers to St. Agnes had failed. Eanfleid told me how Aelwold had persuaded Alfred to give up one of his most precious relics, a feather from the dove that Noah had released from the ark. Aelwold cut the feather into two parts, returning one part to the king, while the other was scorched on a clean pan, and when it was reduced to ash, the scraps were stirred into a cup of holy water, which Aelswith forced her son to drink. He'd been wrapped in lambskin, for the lamb was the symbol of St. Agnes, who had been a child martyr in Rome. But neither feather nor lambskin had worked. If anything, Eanfleid said, the boy was worse. Aelwold was praying over him now.
He's given him the last rites,
Eanfleid said. She looked at me with tears in her eyes.
Can his ult help?
The bishop won't allow it, I said.
He won't allow it?
She asked indignantly.
He's not the one who's dying.
So Isolde was summoned, and Alfred came from the hut, and Aelwold, scenting heresy, came with him. Edward was coughing again, the sound terrible in the evening silence. Alfred flinched at the noise, then demanded to know if Isolde could cure his son's illness. Isolde did not reply at once. Instead she turned and gazed across the swamp to where the moon rose above the mists.
The moon gets bigger, she said. Do you know a cure?
Alfred pleaded.
A growing moon is good,
Isolde said dully, then turned on him.
But there will be a price.
Whatever you want, he said.
Not a price for me,
she said, irritated that he had misunderstood her.
But there's always a price. One lives, another must die.
Heresy!
Aelwold intervened. I doubt Alfred understood Isolde's last three words, or did not care what she meant. He only snatched the tenuous hope that perhaps she could help.
Can you cure my son?
He demanded. She paused, then nodded.
There is a way, she said.
What way?
My way.
Heresy!
Aelwold warned again.
Bishop!
Eanfleid said warningly, and the bishop looked abashed and fell silent.
Now!
Alfred demanded of Isolde.
Tomorrow night,
Isolde said.
It takes time. There are things to do. If he lives till nightfall tomorrow, I can help. You must bring him to me at moonrise.
Not tonight,
Alfred pleaded.
Tomorrow,
Isolde said firmly.
Tomorrow is the feast of St. Vincent,
Alfred said, as though that might help. And somehow the child survived that night, and next day, St. Vincent's Day, Isolde went with me to the eastern shore, where we gathered lichen, burdock, celandine, and mistletoe. She would not let me use metal to scrape the lichen or cut the herbs, and before any was collected,
We had to walk 3 times around the plants, which, because it was winter, were poor and shriveled things. She also made me cut thorn boughs, and I was allowed to use a knife for that because the thorns were evidently not as important as the lichen or herbs. I watched the skyline as I worked, looking for any Danes, but if they patrolled the edge of the swamp, none appeared that day. It was cold, a gusting wind clutching at our clothes. It took a long time to find the plants Isolt needed, but at last her pouch was full, and I dragged the thorn bushes back to the island and took them into the hut where she instructed me to dig 2 holes in the floor.
"They must be as deep as the child is tall,"
she said,
"and as far apart from each other as the length of your forearm."
She'd not tell me what the pits were for. She was subdued, very close to tears. She hung the celandine and burdock from a roof beam, then pounded the lichen and mistletoe into a paste that she moistened with spittle and urine, and she chanted long charms in her own language over the shallow wooden bowl. It all took a long time, and sometimes she just sat exhausted in the darkness beyond the hearth and rocked to and fro.
"I don't know that I can do it,"
she said once.
"You can try,"
I said helplessly.
"And if I fail,"
she said,
"they'll hate me more than ever."
"They don't hate you," I said.
"They think I'm a sinner and a pagan,"
she said,
"and they hate me."
"So cure the child," I said, "and they'll love you." I could not dig the pits as deep as she wanted, for the soil became ever wetter, and, just a couple of feet down, the 2 holes were filling with brackish water.
"Make them wider,"
Isolt ordered me.
"Wide enough so the child can crouch in them."
I did as she said, and then she made me join the 2 holes by knocking a passage in the damp earth wall that divided them. That had to be done carefully to ensure that an arch of soil remained to leave a tunnel between the holes.
"It's wrong,"
Isolt said, not talking of my excavation, but of the charm she planned to work.
"Someone will die, Uhtred. Somewhere, a child will die, so this one will live."
"How do you know that?" I asked.
"Because my twin died when I was born,"
she said,
"and I have his power. But if I use it, he reaches from the dark world and takes the power back."
Darkness fell, and the boy went on coughing, though to my ears it sounded feebler now, as though there was not enough life left in his small body. Eowald was praying still. Isolt crouched in the door of our hut, staring into the rain, and when Alfred came close she waved him away.
"He's dying,"
the king said helplessly.
"Not yet,"
Isolt said.
"Not yet."
Edward's breath rasped. We could all hear it, and we all thought every harsh breath would be his last, and still Isolt did not move. And then at last, a rift showed in the rain clouds, and a feeble wash of moonlight touched the marsh, and she told me to fetch the boy. Aelswith did not want Edward to go. She wanted him cured, but when I said Isolt insisted on working her charms alone, Aelswith wailed that she did not want her son to die apart from his mother. Her crying upset Edward, who began to cough again. Eanfleed stroked his forehead.
"Can she do it?"
she demanded of me. "Yes," I said, and did not know if I spoke the truth. Eanfleed took hold of Aelswith's shoulders.
"Let the boy go, my lady,"
she said.
"Let him go."
"He'll die."
"Let him go,"
Eanfleed said. And Aelswith collapsed into the whore's arms, and I picked up Alfred's son, who felt as light as the feather that had not cured him. He was hot, yet shivering, and I wrapped him in a wool robe and carried him to Isolt.
"You can't stay here,"
she told me.
"Leave him with me."
I waited with Leofric in the dark. Isolt insisted we could not watch through the hut's entrance, But I dropped my helmet outside the door, and by crouching under the eaves, I could just see a reflection of what happened inside. The small rain died, and the moon grew brighter. The boy coughed. Isolde stripped him naked and rubbed her herb paste on his chest. And then she began to chant in her own tongue. An endless chant, it seemed. Rhythmic, sad, and so monotonous that it almost put me to sleep. Edward cried once, and the crying turned to coughing, and his mother screamed from her hut that she wanted him back, and Alfred calmed her, and then came to join us, and I waved him down so that he would not shadow the moonlight before Isolde's door. I peered at the helmet, and saw, in the small reflected firelight, that Isolde, naked herself now, was pushing the boy into one of the pits, and then, still chanting, she drew him through the earth passage. Her chanting stopped, and instead she began to pant, then scream, then pant again. She moaned, and Alfred made the sign of the cross, and then there was silence, and I could not see properly, but suddenly Isolde cried aloud, a cry of relief as if a great pain was ended, and I dimly saw her pull the naked boy out of the second pit. She laid him on her bed, and he was silent as she crammed the thorn bushes into the tunnel of earth. Then she lay beside the boy and covered herself with my large cloak. There was silence. I waited, and waited, and still there was silence. And the silence stretched until I understood that Isolde was sleeping. And the boy was sleeping too, or else he was dead. And I picked up the helmet and went to Leofric's hut.
"Shall I fetch him?"
Alfred asked nervously. "No."
"His mother,"
he began, "must wait till morning, Lord."
"What can I tell her?"
"That her son is not coughing, Lord." Aelswith screamed that Edward was dead, but Eanfleed and Alfred calmed her, and we all waited. And still there was silence, and in the end, I fell asleep. I woke in the dawn. It was raining, as if the world was about to end, a torrential grey rain that swept in vast curtains from the Severn Sea, a rain that drummed on the ground and poured off the reed thatch and made streams on the small island where the little huts crouched. I went to the door of Leofric's shelter, and saw Aelswith watching from her doorway. She looked desperate, like a mother about to hear that her child had died, and there was nothing but silence from Isolde's hut, and Aelswith began to weep, the terrible tears of a bereaved mother. And then, there was a strange sound. At first I could not hear properly, for the seething rain was loud. But then I realized the sound was laughter. A child's laughter. And a heartbeat later, Edward, still naked as an egg and all muddy from his rebirth through the Earth's Passage, ran from Isolde's hut and went to his mother.
"Dear God," Leofric said.
Isolde, when I found her, was weeping and would not be consoled. "I need you," I told her harshly. She looked up at me.
"Need me?"
"To build a bridge." She frowned.
"You think a bridge can be made with spells?"
"My magic this time," I said. "I want you healthy. I need a queen." She nodded. And Edward, from that day forward, thrived. The first men came, summoned by the priests I'd sent onto the mainland. They came in ones and twos, struggling through the winter weather in the swamp, bringing tales of Danish raids. And when we had 2 days of sunshine, they came in groups of six or seven, so that the island became crowded. I sent them out on patrol, but ordered none to go too far west, for I did not want to provoke Svein, whose men were camped beside the sea. He had not attacked us yet, which was foolish of him, for he could have brought his ships up the rivers and then struggled through the marsh.
but I knew he would attack us when he was ready, and so I needed to make our defences. And for that, I needed Æthelingi.